So this year, listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon, and we should be joined shortly by Ramsey Clark, a former Attorney General of the United States. And there's three things we definitely want to talk to him about. He is the founder of the International Action Center, one of the founders, but certainly the principal figure in that. That's IACenter.org, and they are calling for a week of action. It began on, I think, the 28th of June. They're going to be demonstrating in Washington, D.C. and across the United States. Thank heaven there are beginning to be demonstrations. We had these Canadian Syrians demonstrated a week ago at Parliament, Queen's Park, rather. And that was a breakthrough, in my opinion. We need to get clear what these developments on Syria are. So we're going to ask Ramsey Clark about that. We're also going to ask him about the developments with the undermining or perhaps destruction of the Voting Rights Act in the United States. Very shocking development. And since Ramsey Clark is one of the figures who created the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, both in 1964 and 1965, he played a big role in that. We have an authoritative opinion about what this means for black Americans and others. We will also be asking about Lynn Stewart, an American lawyer who is suffering at the moment in a federal prison. She's 73 years old, and she is suffering from cancer, and there is a move afoot to have her released on compassionate grounds, but as of now, there is no evident compassion. But I think we are joined by Mr. Ramsey Clark. Are you there, sir?
I am indeed. How are you?
Very good, and Ramsey, thank you. We're always honored to have you on because you lived through some of these matters. Civil Rights Act, we're going to ask you about that a little later, but right now I know the International Action Center is among those calling for a week of demonstrations and activity, with demonstrations scheduled for Washington, D.C., all focused on the matter of a potential war over Syria. Can you tell us why has the President of the United States personally invested so much attention, using such language as there's a red line that can't be crossed or we will intervene, the president of Syria must step down, we will now supply arms to people crossing the border and waging a mercenary war against the president. How did the United States reach that point? What is this about?
Well, it seems to be the same strategy we've had with all the Arab countries and Muslim countries that we've undermined. I mean, if you take Iraq, our policy has been slow destruction, continuous downgrading. The country suffered since 1990. UN put on two genocidal sanctions, killed hundreds of thousands of children and infants, 500,000 almost in the first 4 years, according to UN's own Food and Agriculture Organization. Children under five dead from the sanctions. You tear the country up and leave it broken. Same thing happened with Afghanistan. The same with Libya. Libyan people are far worse off now than before we messed it up. So now it's serious turn, and basically, you want to divide and diminish the country so it's not a force, so it can be exploited, so it can't injure interests of the United States, like Israel.
Mm-hmm. By the way, I do recall you were so close to so many of these things. You mentioned the attack on Iraq, and at one point, I forget whose administration it was. I think it might have been Bush Sr. They said that they were manufacturing chemical weapons, and you went to the place that had been so identified, and it turned out they were producing powdered milk. Am I right?
Yeah, they don't have dairy farms in the desert, as you can imagine, so they have to import all their milk products, and they decided better, it's cheaper to import the raw materials, dairy milk from New Zealand and Australia, and make infant formula for their children from it. And they had a plant about 30 miles northwest of Baghdad where they were doing that. U.S. destroyed it, and we went up there, and even in the office it was destroyed. You could find the architect's plans for the plant. It was a French company, as I recall, and a Belgian country was involved too, in the design and construction of the plant. And there were a lot of destroyed packages. The only guy that was there, he opened a package and eat some of it to show you it wasn't some kind of a secret weapon.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's such a pattern because you also exposed the time when Bill Clinton attacked Sudan, and he said that there was some kind of chemical plant there. And I know you were one of the people who visited, and others. There was a lawsuit over that. It was exposed that in fact they were in that case producing pharmaceutical material, very necessary fighting malaria, but. We have a pattern here where really broad-gauge lies are laid out and provide an excuse for total assault on a country, and it keeps happening. One wonders what is going on in the political culture that there is not people on their feet saying, "Are you kidding? You told me the same story about Iraq. You told me the same story about Sudan. You told me the same story about Libya." But I don't hear those voices. I guess Mr. Kucinich, a few people, I don't know.
Yeah, there have been very few voices speaking out. But basically, we tear them up and then leave them broken. Or sit on them for a while. But poor Iraq, I don't know anybody that suffered more than that. I went there every year from 1990 through 2003 and back in 2005 and 2006 for the Saddam Hussein trials. And just misery all those years, death and... fear of violence at all times, and millions of people in different parts of the country and are outside their own country, and you leave them broken. Sudan wasn't that severe. We sent Tomahawk cruise missiles in, kind of a sporting game, and knocked out a pharmaceutical plant, biggest pharmaceutical plant in North Africa, Northeast Africa.
My memory is that saved Clinton's marriage. He had a little problem at that time. We're speaking to Ramsey Clark, and the latest rationale, or I shouldn't call it rationale, the accusation from the U.S. is to focus on Hezbollah, it's a political and military operation in Lebanon. And the U.S. saying Hezbollah is in violation of international law, et cetera. I'd like to just know, how do you react when you hear the U.S. talking that way, as though this might be another reason that they could get themselves involved?
I don't know any country in my lifetime that's interfered violently in the affairs of other countries and surreptitiously than the United States. I mean, that's what we've been doing in all these countries we've been talking about. And Hezbollah is a strong presence in Lebanon, an important presence. Its leadership is important in the government there, and it's been an important defender of the territorial integrity of Lebanon. But it also has close ties to Syria and supports Syria, so they go over there and try and help and. That gives us an excuse to do what we want to do anyway, and have done, and that's attack them.
The neighboring states that have been working hand in glove with the United States on these matters, with NATO, such as Turkey, which is very aggressive in its language towards Syria, and then there is Egypt and Qatar, they seem to be having a few problems of their own. Do you think that perhaps Syria's strength in this situation might be causing some trepidation in those capitals?
I doubt if it's... I mean, they've got plenty of problems themselves. I think any threat from Syria would be insignificant compared to their problems. Turkey's been wrestling with its Kurdish people.
Mm-hmm.
I should say, been wrestling them down, torturing them for years. I've been over there, I don't know how many times, to try to protect the rights of the people. They wouldn't even let them speak their own language. We were in Diyarbakir one time, which is the largest city in the capital of the Kurdish area, and had a big indoor meeting, and then went off to look at the border where the U.S. was participating in support for Turkey, which was invading Iraq at the time, testing Kurdish people, and they assassinated three or four of the people that were on the stage with us in the theater there in Diyarbakir. Their Kurdish problem is a big problem. They've got other divisions within their country, and they are, you know, NATO ally and one of our principal defenders in the area, but they've got internal problems. We want to hold them together. We want to use them against Syria as much as we can for other purposes.
The reaction of the Russia and of China has been a little sharper since the Libya experience, and this crisis in Syria, in the first year or so, it was talked about continually in association with Hezbollah and of Iran, with some saying openly, people like McCain and others saying, after we take care of Syria, we're going to have to take care of Iran. They seem to be a little quieter on that front, but is there, in your view, a more serious pushback from states like China and Russia that is maybe making people be a little more careful about their language and behavior?
Well, you'd hope so, but it's doubtful. I haven't detected any real deterrent yet, but I think it's coming closer to being a deterrent. It hasn't been a deterrent on Syria. We're accomplishing pretty much as we did with Libya this time. We unloaded the responsibility for the major direct violent attacks on Libya to NATO friends, letting the blood be on their hands rather than ours. And the Libyan people are so much far worse off than they were before. Libya was given more aid to sub-Saharan Africa than the United States or any other country in the world, probably more than all other countries in the world.
Mm-hmm.
They had withdrawn from the Arab League because they thought it was just an oil cartel.
Oh, they noticed.
and joined the African League and were providing enormous effort for health and food and for all the countries of sub-Saharan Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Including South Africa.
Yes, as people are now with, you know, inevitably with the condition of Mr. Mandela, I notice how there's all this reverential discussion. However, when Mandela and other South African leaders asked them to not molest Libya, they were not listened to at all. It's sort of a sad commentary, isn't it?
I think they had no power of persuasion whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine the people in the State Department thought it was insolent. That they, it was a suggestion that they would say something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
After all we've done for them, or to them.
Yeah, it's one or the other.
I remember being in Angola one day when an African, South African column was coming up toward the capital, and the only thing that saved Angola, which is, you know, bigger than Texas and could feed all of Africa. If the plains there are richer than the... I mean, agriculture in Texas is huge, but Angola could feed all of sub-Saharan Africa if it had to. Here was South Africa trying to... This is, of course, well, it was still apartheid, but and white control, but they were... the struggle to maintain domination over Southern Africa, all of Southern Africa.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Ramsey Clark, and he is one of the founders of the International Action Center, iacenter.org. And Ramsey, I hope those are big demonstrations that you're going to be having in Washington and elsewhere in the U.S. But I want to also ask you about something that must be very close to your heart, this recent decision of the United States Supreme Court, which seems to have done damage to the Voter Rights Act of 1965 and of the Civil Rights Act, of which you were one. You invested a great deal of energy and part of your life in fighting for that. What's your assessment of this most recent decision?
Well, it's a tragic effort to turn back the clock to show that it shows that racism still powerful element in national politics. They Texas, my home state, almost immediately started to work on its law so that they could diminish the influence of African American and even more so now Latin American vote, which are together a majority of Texas, if you can believe it. So they could gerrymander them into corners where their impact, particularly on the state legislature and the House of Representatives representation, would be held at a minimum, much less than their proportion of the population.
Mm-hmm.
It's trying to roll the clock back to maintain white dominance. Sad coming. I was Deputy Attorney General at the time of the Voting Rights Act and had responsibility for drafting it, and from the standpoint of the executive branch of the government, honchoing it through the Congress, and it was the most important civil rights legislative victory we had. Not the most fundamentally important, housing was that, but voting made an enormous difference in the South. Made it Republican, for one thing. It had been solid Democrat before that.
By the way, people have to appreciate that Lyndon Johnson and yourself, you were part of that administration, that was a heroic moment. The president actually did act out of character and belief in type of country the place is supposed to be. And he said, I understand, and you would know better than I, that, okay, this means my party is going to be in for a drubbing. But he went ahead and did it anyway because it was the right thing to do.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. And he knew it better than anybody. I wasn't that finely tuned on the political aspects of it, but it's pretty obvious that the South had been solid Democratic. I mean, Roosevelt carried all the southern states. Truman carried them. Kennedy carried them. And now states like Mississippi are, which is, you know, the poorest and most segregated of all, are solid Republicans as far as the Congress is concerned.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, this decision also flies in the face of when Congress voted, they were still for it, right? I mean, the Congress has never turned its back in terms of its votes on this decision for maintaining the Voter Rights Act.
Well, this is a reflection of the new composition of Congress nationally, where you've got majority Republican in one chamber, the House, where most legislation is initiated, which is an essential element in achieving new laws, changing old laws. It's Republican control, and that's one reason for our comparative paralysis. You can't get laws through because you've got a division in power, and it enables a conservative minority to essentially block, that is, the national population. block legislation the country and the people desperately need.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty sad situation.
It is. It is interesting. There seems to be like a cycles here. I won't haste to use expressions like that, but Lincoln, here we are. This is the anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg, and what we remember about Gettysburg is the speech about Gettysburg where he said, we're testing whether or not we can survive as believing in equality. And then he called on the people for a new birth of freedom, and boy, it was 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. But about 10 years after, the Old South leadership reasserted themselves and did something along the lines of what we're seeing with this kind of behavior by the Supreme Court, right?
Yeah, it's, how the world's changed fundamentally in the nature of its life because of technology. Politically, it's a reactionary element in a region of the country wielding disproportionate influence on the national destiny. And it's in harmony with the interests of wealth in the rest of the country, so it compounds the power that it has.
Mm-hmm. I guess I should ask, what do you project? There is reaction to this. The most difficult thing that they're facing is that the way this decision is written, the undoing this decision is going to be a lot of heavy lifting, isn't it?
It's going to be a long process, and it'll be an imperfect repair job. Mm-hmm. Hopefully there'll be some repairs, but it's going to be state by state largely, and it's going to take time, and the advantage will be to those in power to hold their power. Mm-hmm. So it's an obstructionist act to...
Mm-hmm.
For a decade or more, it's a heavy blow to the country.
Yeah. We're talking to Ramsey Clark. Of course, he was the Attorney General of the United States under Lyndon Johnson and closely involved in the Civil Rights Act and the Voters' Rights Act, a tremendous accomplishment. Ramsey, before we go here, I want to make sure I ask you about this wonderful woman, Lynn Stewart, lawyer. I understand also somebody says... librarian. I love librarians. And she's 73 years old, and she was defending a controversial client and really paid a heavy, heavy price. She's in prison, has cancer, and there is no compassion, appeals to compassion on the part of leaders to let her go home. What do you make of this situation?
Well, it's an enormous tragedy, and tragically for me, I'm heavily involved. I got her into the case. I'd been asked to represent Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, he'd asked me. He was in jail, of course. We had associates in his mosque that he was preaching in here come and ask me. And I was involved in a Haitian case and said I'd get on the case as soon as I could, but finally decided that then... It'd be wonderful to have a woman representing a conservative, internationally known Muslim scholar like Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, and brought her into the case, and from it, for trying to help him after the conviction while he was in prison, being kind to him, basically. She was charged herself and convicted, sentenced initially by the judge to 28 months, and the Court of Appeals raised a fuss, and three cents to 10 years, and now she's 73 years old and dying of cancer. We don't know how long she has to live. It's not very long, and under our compassionate release statute, she should have been released before now, but the Bureau of Prisons has just found that without showing any basis for it, any new medical reports, the warden at the women's medical hospital in the Federal Bureau of Prisons where she's held had recommended compassionate release.
The warden?
The warden had, yeah. Now, but under the statute, it has to go to the director for the whole Federal Bureau of Prisons for the whole country. The warden's just in charge of her one prison, which is the only medical prison for women in the federal system. It's at Fort Worth, Texas. But they recommend it, and the grounds are just as solid as they can be. I mean, her health is desperate. The cancer is spread, metastasized, and in her bones and in her lungs. It started out in her breast. She's just a uniquely wonderful person. She started out as a school teacher and a librarian, and then shifted to law and became a very effective criminal defense lawyer, basically for poor people for nothing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Devoted her life to it, and the trial of Shaco Margo Rockman, he was a prisoner. He didn't have any money. That was basically pro bono, too. It took about 8 months of trial, close to nine. Mm-hmm. And now she's there. But the politicians are both hateful against her and afraid of, and the righteous ones are afraid of saying anything because she's been called a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
Because she represented an Egyptian imam who was acquitted in the case involving the assassination of Anwar Sadat because an Egyptian military court knew what imams do. They don't carry guns and shoot people. They don't organize people to go out and shoot people. They tell you what the Quran says and what your moral obligation is. And that's all he ever did. He didn't do anything to hurt anybody, or he didn't suggest to anybody else they go do anything to hurt anybody. But he was convicted in the U.S. court, which Lynn brilliantly defended him against, in a post 9/11 environment that was pre 9/11, but it was post the first bombing of the World Trade Center. You know, that truck that exploded underneath one of the buildings and killed several people. Just post that, and post the fear of terrorism generally in the country.
And so Lynn Stewart becomes a target. In a way you've outlined it, but it is just, it's ethical paralysis, right? Powerful leaders are not capable, apparently, at the moment, of being able to say, no, we don't want this person to die in a prison. Of course they can go home. They can't even bring themselves to say that.
Well, ethical paralysis is the ineffective negative side of putting it there, but you've got effective unethical
mm-hmm.
power that's prevailing, which is worse.
Well, let's hope. I know you're fighting the International Action Center and others are fighting to get her freed. I hope that she is.
I'll talk to Lynn in the morning at 11 o'clock on the telephone. We'll see where we go from here.
Well, we're going to keep up with that. And Ramsey, it's always wonderful to talk to you, and thank you very, very much for all the information.
Well, Phil, thanks for your many good works in so many parts of the world and your important voice for Canada up there. Good to hear you always.
All right. Thank you, Ramsey.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Ramsey Clark, former Attorney General of the United States, and I would tell you he has covered the ground perfectly. This is the Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report. Write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And Terry, thank you. Phil Connor, thank you. And we'll see you next week.